Okay. So it's always very, very hard for me to teach in Kishagar, not because I can't drink, but because I can't start with hello. So I won't say hello. It's so hard for me. So the topic that Padas has chosen for today is Cheshbon Nefesh. And the thing we generally do Cheshbon Nefesh for on Tisha B'Av, for those among us who are not guilty of murder, idolatry, or incest, is Sinat Chinam, baseless hatred. But I'd like to claim that most of us here are about as guilty of Sinat Chinam, of baseless hatred, as we are of murder, idolatry, or incest. In fact, how many people here can honestly say they've ever experienced truly baseless hatred? Show of hands. Would you like to tell us about that?
No.
No. And that is because most of us, when we experience hatred, it is based full. It is hatred with a basis. In fact, I would say the more basis our hatred has, the more important that basis is, the greater our hatred. And as such, there is perhaps no hatred so great as the hatred that is elicited by the study of Torah. Look at number 2 on your source sheet. I will read it out. Even father and son, master and disciple, who study Torah at the same gate, become enemies of each other. Yet they do not stand from there until they come to love each other. So the study of Torah actually makes friends into enemies. And according to the Talmud, this is perhaps inevitable. We can't really study something so deeply personal, can't debate something so deeply personal and meaningful without the discussion becoming extremely visceral. And I'm not going to name any examples, but I'm sure you can all think of them, of our great religious debates, our halachic controversies, our denominational conflicts, particularly acrimonious, particularly ugly and hateful. And so the story I'd like to do with you for the next hour and a half is precisely about this. It is about the deeply personal hatred that is inspired by the study of Torah. And I think we should be aware of this, because the more aware we are, the better we can manage these debates and ultimately, hopefully, come to love each other in the end. So the story I'd like to do with you is in Barakama 117. Those of you who were in my Shia here last Tisha B'Av, we studied the story of Rav's immigration from Israel to Babylon. This is something of the flip side. This is the immigration of Rav Kahana from Babylon to Israel. But before we look at the story, one very basic rule of thumb when studying Talmudic narrative, Agadah must always be studied in its context, both the textual context, the sugya in which the story appears, and the historical context, the world in which the story is born. Hands up if you don't have a source sheet. And then please pass down to people whose hands are raised. And please still be generous and share, because we want to make sure that people have one by one among two or three, another among five. And I'd like to start with the historical context. Generally, when we try, anybody still not have a sitting next to someone who hasn't got? Raise your hands. So when we try historically date a Talmudic story, we generally go by the historical characters in the story. Now, our story features two major historical personages. One is Rav, who is the greatest rabbi of his time, the first generation of Babylonian Amorim. And we have Rabbi Yochanan, who is the greatest rabbi of his time, the second generation of Israeli Amorim. Now, in our case, it gets a bit tricky because in the story, as we'll see, Rabbi Yochanan is very old, and by the time Rabbi Yochanan is very old, Rav has already been dead for quite a while. So it doesn't historically fit entirely, but we can very generally say that our story dates to the 3rd century, which is the beginning of the Talmudic era. Right? The Talmud is finally sealed, the Mishnah is finally sealed in the year 200, and we transition from the age of the Mishnah to the age of the Talmud. One of the defining features of this time is an intense rivalry between Babylon and Israel. We have two rabbinic epicenters that are vying for control over the Jewish world. And again, I said this last year. On the one hand, we have Israel, which is the older, more established center. It is now in the north, but it is very much basking in the former glory of Jerusalem and Yavne. However, political instability and persecution means that it is constantly on the decline and nowhere near as glorious as it used to be in the past. On the other hand, we have Babylon. Now, Babylon is the newer, more fledgling center, but relative economic political stability and economic prosperity means that it is constantly on the rise. Why is this tension important? It's important for two reasons. One, it gives rise to a tradition within the Talmud of tales of immigrant rabbis. Rabbis who travel either from Babylon to Israel or from Israel to Babylon. Again, we looked at one such story last year. And because of the rivalry and suspicion between these two centers, upon their arrival, they are met with a lot of hostility, mockery, humiliation, sometimes even physical abuse as they try and establish themselves in their new home. And our story very much belongs to this tradition. On the other hand, toward the end of the Talmudic era, Babylon has clearly won the battle. It is now the leading force in the Jewish world, and Babylonian rabbis become very anxious to assert their superiority, their intellectual and ethical superiority over their Israeli counterparts. And so what we have from this time, and this is around the time in which our story was written, is a very strong pro-Babylonian polemical thrust in the writing of these rabbis. Look at number 3, and can I ask for somebody with loud voice who's not that thirsty to please read? Anyone? You all that thirsty?
The Torah was firmly established in Jerusalem from the Hasmoneans onwards until the time of the destruction of the temple. From that time onwards, there are two academies, whose fragrance goes forth from one end of the world to the other, to teach you that the divine presence left Jerusalem and settled in Babylon.
The divine presence left Jerusalem and settled in Babylon. And our story, too, belongs to this polemical thrust, and these two points of context I want for us to keep in mind as we read our story. One last bit of background, and then we'll dive straight in, and that is a textual context. The story, as I said, comes in Baba Kama. It comes as part of a sugya of Dinei Mosel. Mosel is a Jewish informant, a man who threatens the life or the property of a fellow Jew by informing on them to the authorities. And according to Jewish law, under certain particular circumstances, and this is not, I'm not at all encouraging the, don't go out and do this, but according to some very theoretical circumstances, you can sometimes kill a mosel to protect the life of the Jew he's threatening. And so there is a very long, intricate debate as to when these circumstances might be in place. And then appears our story. It's a number 1, and would you read on, please? It's like many a Talmudic drama, this is a story in 3 acts, and we're going to begin with the beginning of Act 1.
A certain man who wished to reveal another man's straw to the tax authorities appeared before Rav. "Do not reveal it, do not reveal it," he said. "I shall reveal it," he replied. Rav Kahana was sitting before Rav. and he tore out that man's windpipe.
Thank you. Got your attention now. Letting out a bit of violence. Okay, let's start with a setting of the scene. Where does this act take place? Speak out. In Babylon. Where in Babylon? In the Beit Midrash of Rav, right? There was a would-be moser, an informant, who comes before Rav and he wants to inform upon his neighbor's property, and Rav says, I absolutely forbid it, and the man says, oh, but I shall, and Rav Kahana is so enraged by this show of defiance towards his rabbi that he jumps on the man and tears out his windpipe. Why he tears out the windpipe is a very, very interesting question. It has to do with other textual traditions we won't go into, but I suppose it's as good a way as any to kill a man. And I want to zoom in on the character of Rav Kahana, who is one of the two antagonists in our story. What do we learn about Rav Kahana just from this opening scene? What kind of man is he?
Violent.
Violent, good. What else?
Impulsive.
Good.
Zealous.
Good.
Strong.
Good. Wonderful. And he also, I will add, is the Talmid Muvhak, a very, very loyal disciple of Rav. Now, to get a full sense of what Rav Kahana was really like as a person, I'd like for us to look at a parallel text. We have two stories of Rav Kahana's immigration to Israel. One is at the Bavli, which is what we're looking at now. The other is in the Yerushalmi. And to get a more well-rounded picture of him, I want us to look at that source now, which is in number 4. I love that you're reading and doing the voices. Would you tell us when you get tired? Thank you.
The young Kahana was a prodigy. When he came here, a certain ruffian saw him and said to him, what's being said up in heaven? Your death has been sealed, was his reply. And so it came to pass that the man died. Another such fellow saw him and said to him, what's being said up in heaven? Your death has been sealed. He again replied, and so it was.
Thank you. So Rav Kahana steps off the boat, is encountered by this ruffian, who says, what is going up there in heaven? Basically mocking him, either for his being an intellectual and having his head up in the clouds, or for his being very, very tall. And Rav Kahana, without missing a beat, says, your death sentence has been sealed, and the man promptly dies, and then another man tries to be smart again, and he also dies, and the lesson to be learned from this is never, ever make fun of people's hearts. I do not appreciate it. Go on.
He went before Rav Yochanan and said to him, a person whose mother despises him and whose father's wife respects him, to whom should he go? He replied, he should go to the one who respects him. Thereupon Rav Kahana left here. After he had gone, they came and told Rav Yochanan that Rav Kahana had left for Babylonia. He said, what? Did he leave without receiving my permission? They answered him, that which he asked you was for him, your permission.
Thank you. So what do we learn about Rav Kahana from this source? Sorry? Respect, honor is very important to him. Good. What else? You have to speak up.
He was more respected in Babylon.
He was more respected in Babylon than in Israel. We'll see that's very true of our own story. What else? He's brilliant. He's very smart. Good. Good.
In both stories, he has respect for authority, but he also knows how to circumvent it and get to where he wants to go.
Good, good, good. And I would say, also in both stories, there is an element of hot-headedness here. And if I had to sum up, I would say that Rav Kahana is very smart, very proud, and very hot-headed. And these are the three legs of rabbinic hubris. In fact, Anywhere in the Talmud where you encounter a rabbi who has these three traits, you can be almost certain the story is not going to end well. Let's go back to our story. The end of the third line, Rav thereupon.
Rav thereupon recited the following verse. Thy sons have fainted, they lie at the heads of all the streets as a wild bull in a net. Just as this wild bull, when he falls into a net, none have mercy upon it, so when the property of a Jew falls into the hands of a non-Jew, no mercy is shown towards it.
Thank you. So Rav essentially is justifying the killing. This man was indeed a Moser, and Rav Kahana was right to kill him. But then he goes on to say,
then Rav said to him, Kahana, till now, here there were the Greeks who did not take account of bloodshed. But now there are the Persians who take account of bloodshed, and they will cry out, murder, murder. Arise then and go to the land of Israel, and take upon yourself not to question Rabbi Yochanan for 7 years.
Thank you. So Rav here is alluding to what we know is an actual historical incident that happened during his lifetime. The regime change in the Babylonian Empire from the Parthians to the Sassanids. Basically, the Parthians ran an almost feudal regime. They allowed a great deal of autonomy to the different ethnic and religious subgroups, and each subgroup was allowed to sort of settle its affairs within itself. However, now the country is run by the Sassanids, who were far more centralized and tried to impose one law throughout the land. And so Rav is concerned because, with all due respect to the Jewish laws of Mosul, Rav Kahana is still guilty of murder in the eyes of the laws, and he will get into trouble. And so he sends him to Israel and makes him promise not to say a word in Rabbi Yochanan's Beit Midrash for 7 years. Why this strange promise? Not rhetorical.
Well, he knows that Kahana's hot-headed and very smart, and he's going to cause problems if he talks.
Good, good, very good. And I'm going to add to that something of Rav's own biography, and again, I referred to last year's class. Rav, we know, spent many years himself studying in Israel. And he knows that there is a stark difference between the way they learn Torah in Israel and the way they learn Torah in Babylon. Look at number six.
Israel treat each other graciously when engaged in halakhic debates. The scholars of Babylon injure each other's feelings when discussing halakha. The scholars of Israel are affable to each other when engaged in halakhic debates. The scholars of Babylon are as bitter to each other in halakhic discussions.
Thank you. So Rav knows that the study of Torah in Babylon is far more harsh and competitive. And he is afraid that if Rav Kahana, being as naturally hot-headed as he is, takes this more violent mode of study with him to Israel, that might land him in a lot of trouble, which we'll see is precisely what happens. So Rav says to Rav Kahana, lay low, stay silent for 7 years, until you get the way of the land. Let's go back to our story and move on to Act 2. Are you good to continue? A little bit.
He went and found Resh Lakish sitting and going over the daily lesson before the students of the academy.
Thank you. So again, as the curtain rises on Act 2, let's begin with a setting of the scene. Where does this act take place? In the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yochanan, which is in Tiberias. When does this beginning of the act take place?
Sorry. 7 years later? Or
yeah. No, it's immediately upon his arrival. But what time of day is it?
Morning.
Morning? It's in the evening. It's in the end of the day. The teacher has Rabbi Yochanan has gone home, and Reish Lakish, who is Rabbi Yochanan's Talmid Chavel, his junior associate, his TA, if you will, is going over the daily class. And so we see here, we have, between Act 1 and Act 2, we have two pairs of rabbi disciples. Right? We have Rav and Rav Kahana in Act 1, and Rabbi Yochanan in Reish Lakish in Act 2, and our conflict, as a sort of, our conflict is going to be between the disciple of one pair and the rabbi of the other pair. Let's read on.
He went and found Reish Lakish sitting and going over the daily lessons before the students arrived. He said to them, "Where is Reish Lakish?" "Why do you want to know?" they asked him. He replied, "There is in the lecture this question and this question and this answer and this answer."
Thank you. So Osama Reish Lakish goes home, and then Rav Kahana approaches the students and says, "You know, you could have asked this question, this question, this question, given this answer, this answer, this answer." What is he doing?
Stirring.
Sorry?
Stirring.
Stirring?
Yeah, undermining the answers.
Showing off.
Showing off. Now, I want to point out that he's not technically breaking his promise, right? He was told specifically not to ask the Rabbi Yochanan any questions. The Rabbi Yochanan has gone home for the day. But we can already see here an eagerness to show off his Talmudic knowledge, which doesn't bode well for his ability to actually keep his promise. Let's read on.
They went and told Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish went and told Rabbi Yochanan, "A lion has come up from Babylon. Let the master look carefully into tomorrow's lecture."
Thank you. So Reish Lakish goes to his rabbi and warns him, "There's this great lion, this scholar who's coming from Babylon. Go over tomorrow's class so that he doesn't embarrass you." And at this point, I want to zero in on the character of Rabbi Yochanan, who is our second antagonist. Now, Rabbi Yochanan, as I said, greatest rabbi of his time. This is second generation Israel, Israeli Amoraim. And again, to get a sense of what kind of person he was, I want to look at a parallel text, a text that has many similarities with our own. And that is the story of his very, very charged relationship with Reish Lakish in Bava Metzia, in number 7. Just to give you a bit of background, because I didn't quote the whole story, it's very, very well known. Reish Lakish starts his life off as the head of a gang of robbers. He's a ringleader. And one day he passes by the Jordan River, and Rabbi Yochanan is swimming in the river. And Reish Lakish mistakes him for a woman, and he's overcome by desire and jumps on in after him and swims until he finally reaches him, when he discovers that Rabbi Yochanan is in fact a man. And Rabbi Yochanan says, "Chelech le'oraita, you are so strong, you should be studying Torah. Your strength is for Torah." And Reish Lakish retorts, "Your beauty is for women." And so Rabbi Yochanan says, "Well, actually, I have a sister who's far more beautiful than I. If you do tshuva, I will give you her hand in marriage." And so Reish Lakish does tshuva, marries Rabbi Yochanan's sister, and because he is, in fact, that stronger man, both physically and intellectually, very quickly becomes the leading student in Rabbi Yochanan's Beit Midrash, until one day the following incident occurs. Does anybody else want to read, give you a bit of a break? Anyone? Thank you.
"One day there was a dispute in the schoolhouse with respect to the following: a sword, knife, dagger, spear, handsaw, and a scythe. At what stage of their manufacture can they become unclean? When their manufacture is finished. And when is their manufacture finished? Rabbi Yochanan rules, when they are tempered in a furnace. Reish Lakish maintains, when they have been furbished in water. Said he to him, a robber understands his truth."
Thank you. So what is happening is they're having a halachic debate about particular types of weapons. Rabbi Yochanan says one thing. Reish Lakish counters him. And Rabbi Yochanan, in a sort of below-the-belt comment, says, "Well, of course you know all about weapons, don't you? Isn't that what you used to use in your former life?" Go on, please.
"Said he to him, and wherewith have you benefited me? There, as a robber, I was called master, and here I am called master. By bringing you under the wings of the Shekhinah," he was told.
Thank you. So Reish Lakish, very deeply hurt, says, "You know what? You haven't done all that much for me. I was a leader there, I'm a leader here. You haven't made that big a difference in my life." And Rabbi Yochanan, who is then also very much hurt, says, "No, but I brought you under the wings of the Shekhinah." Go on.
"Rabbi Yochanan therefore felt himself deeply hurt, as a result of which Reish Lakish fell ill and died.
Thank you. So the phrase used here is Khalsha Date. Rabbi Yochanan was deeply, deeply devastated. And Khalsha Date is a rather ominous phrase in the Talmud because it generally brings about the death of whoever has caused the devastation. And sure enough, Reish Lakish falls ill and dies. Go on, please.
And Rabbi Yochanan was plunged into deep grief. Said the rabbis, "Who shall go to ease his mind? Let Rabbi Eliezer ben Hadad go, whose dispositions are very subtle." So he went and sat before him, and on every dictum uttered by Rabbi Yochanan, he observed, "There is the brisa which supports you. Are you as the son of Lakisha?" He complained. "When I stayed in the law, the son of Lakisha used to raise 24 objections, to which I gave 24 answers, which consequently led to a fuller comprehension of the law, while you say, a brisa has been taught which supports you. Do I not know myself that my dicta are right?" Thus he went on, rending his garments and weeping, "Where are you, O son of Lakisha? Where are you, O son of Lakisha?" And he cried thus until his mind was turned. Thereupon the rabbis prayed for him, and he died.
So after killing, essentially, his chavruta, Rabbi Yochanan is plunged into a deep grief. He's brought another man, another chavruta, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hadad, who ends up agreeing with everything he says, until Rabbi Yochanan, in his despair, says, "I don't need this kind of yes man. I know I'm correct. I want Reish Lakish, who would argue with me and counter me and challenge me and make my teachings better." And he was inconsolable until the rabbis prayed for mercy for him and he died. What do we learn about Rabbi Yochanan from this story?
Very emotional.
Emotional, good.
Also impulsive.
Also impulsive, good. I heard something else over there? Sorry? He expects to be challenged. He also dreads it. There's an ambivalence there about the challenge. Good.
He wants to be challenged, but not proved wrong.
He wants to be challenged, but not proved wrong. How human is that?
He's very attached to Reish Lakish.
He's very attached to Reish Lakish. If I had to, again, narrow it down, I would say that Rabbi Yochanan is very wise, very proud, and very hot-headed. Again, those very three components of rabbinic hubris that we found with Rav Kahana, and now we know that the story can't end well. Let's go back to our story. Rachel, would you go on with, on the following day, it's about six lines into the second paragraph.
On the following day, they placed him in the first row before Rabbi Yochanan.
Thank you. Okay, just a word about the architecture of the Beit Midrash. This is probably true of Babylon, not of Israel, but the author was living in Babylon and he wrote about what he knew, what he knew. Basically, the way the Beit Midrash would be organized would be that on the first row, right in front of the rabbi, would be all of the star students, the ones who could best dialogue with the rabbi. And then, in descending order, the rest of the students were placed until they reached the very, very final row, which was there for the weaker students and the auditors. Sorry, all of them. And Rav Kahana, who is this lion, this prodigy, is accordingly placed in the very first row. Go on, please.
He, Rabbi Yochanan, made a statement, but he, Rav Kahana, did not question it. He made another statement, and again, he did not question it.
Thank you. So another word this time about the pedagogy of the Beit Midrash. The way the class would work is the rabbi would recite a teaching, the students would question it, and the rabbi would try to answer the question. And that would be the way the lesson was conducted. And everybody expected Rav Kahana, again being as brilliant as he was, to discourse with the rabbi, and Rav Kahana, as we know, has to stay silent. Go on, please.
They moved him back seven rows until he was seated in the final row.
So with every teaching that Rabbi Yochanan makes and Rav Kahana fails to question, he is moved back and moved back and moved back until he finally finds himself on the final row with the laymen and the weaklings. Go on, please.
Said Rabbi Yochanan to Reish Lakish, the lion you spoke of has become a fox.
Thank you. And he is also demoted from being a lion and the greatest of the animals to a fox, the most lowly. And we might ask ourselves whether this was said quietly to Reish Lakish or very publicly in front of all of the laymen rush. And I would like to suggest that it was said publicly because of what happens next. Go on.
Said Rav Kahana, may it be thy will that these 7 rows may be in place of the 7 years during which Rav told me I might raise no questions. He rose to his feet and
thank you. I'll stop you there. And so Rav Kahana cannot bear the humiliation anymore and feels he must violate his promise to Rav. And like Einstein, he converts space into time, the rows into the years, and he rises to his feet. Now, we have a recurring verb in this story, to rise, come. It occurs in all 3 acts, and in all 3 acts, it signifies a critical turning point in the narrative. In the first act, we have kam sak le'arad Yisrael, rise and go to Israel. And here we have kam akalya, he rose to his feet, and the tables begin to turn. Go on, please.
He rose to his feet and said to Rabbi Yochanan, will the master please start the lecture from the beginning?
Thank you. So just as Rabbi Yochanan moved Rav Kahana to the back of the yeshiva, the matita, now Rav Kahana is moving Rabbi Yochanan back to the beginning of the daily lesson, which is also the matita. And I think we all know what's going to happen next. Go on.
He, Rabbi Yochanan, made a statement, and Rav Kahana raised a question against it. And so they placed him in the first row.
Thank you. So all of this knowledge that was pent up inside of him now comes pouring out, and Rav Kahana asks question after question after question, questions which Rabbi Yochanan cannot answer. Now the phrase that is used in this context is Akshay Ukmei. Akshay Ukmei is a Talmudic phrase used to denote the very personally contentious situation where one rabbi stumps another rabbi with a question he cannot answer. Now, teachers very often find this scenario, being asked a question they can't answer, as terrifying, which is very, very silly. But in the rabbinic world, it wasn't just embarrassing. It was detrimental. In fact, one of the best ways to undermine a rabbi in a Beit Midrash was to akshay ukmei him, to ask him a question he cannot answer. Look at number 9. Are you going to continue?
Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan were not present on that day. Coming on the following day and seeing that the people did not rise for them as usual, they inquired as to what had happened. On being told that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel had issued that ordinance, Rabbi Meir said to Rabbi Nathan, how are we to proceed against him? Let us request him to discourse upon the tractate of Hukin with which he is unfamiliar, and he will be unable to discourse upon it. We shall then depose him, and I shall become Av Beit Din, and you the Nasit.
Thank you. So basically, without going into too much detail, we have some sort of political feud here between the patriarch, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan. And so they hatch a plan to undermine him, to depose him, basically by creating a scenario of Akshay Ukmei. Let's ask him to teach something he doesn't know too well, and then we'll ask him questions he can't answer. His credibility would be shot, and we will depose him. Go on, please.
Rabbi Yaakov ben Korshai, on hearing this conversation, went and sat down behind Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's study, expounding the tractate of Rukin and repeating it again and again. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel concentrated his attention and familiarized himself with it. On the following day, when they said to him, will the master come and discourse on Rukin? He began and discoursed upon it. After he finished, he said to them, had I not familiarized myself with it, you would have disgraced me.
Thank you. And note that here also the plan is foiled by the sidekick who goes and reports to the rabbi and makes sure that he's prepared on time. And so with every question, with every brilliant question that Rav Kahana asks and Rabbi Yochanan cannot answer, he has moved forward until he finds himself back in his rightful place at the front of the class. Now you would think that would be enough for him, but it's not, and he keeps going. Let's go back to our story. He made a further statement.
He made a further statement and he questioned it. Rabbi Yochanan was seated on 7 cushions. They pulled one cushion from beneath him. He made another statement and again he questioned it, and they pulled until they pulled all the cushions from beneath him, so that he was now sitting on the ground.
Thank you. So we had a convention in the royal Persian courts where, again, was the world with which our author was familiar, of sitting on cushions. Look at number 10.
His Majesty holds court. There is beside him a great pile of rectangular, thin, flat cushions. A guest who merits recognition is given as a mark of honor the bards, or cushions to sit on, presented from the pile beside him, as if he be a personage of very high degree who may even receive
you. Thank you. And here we have this almost, you know, princess and the pea scenario, where we have 7 cushions, and with every brilliant, further, additional brilliant question that Rav Kahana asks and Rabbi Yochanan cannot answer, one cushion is pulled out beneath him, and he is finally sitting on the floor. And noted the great movement in this act. We have backwards and forwards and up and down, this rapid shift in power. A complete measure for measure. Just as Rabbi Yochanan had sent Rav Kahana back 7 rows, Rav Kahana is now bringing Rabbi Yochanan down 7 pillars. And so, humiliated in front of his students, undermined in his very own yeshiva, Rabbi Yochanan is quite literally dethroned. Let's read on.
Rabbi Yochanan was an old man, and his eyelids drooped over his eyes. He said to them, "Lift my eyelids for me, so that I may see."
Okay, stop, stop, stop. What? What did we just discover? He is blind. Okay, the Rabbi Yochanan we met in the previous story, he is now old and his eyelids are drooping and he cannot see. And this entire act, this entire tug of war with Rav Kahana was fought without the advantage of sight. He hasn't seen anything this entire time. And because we only discover this now, and because it changes everything, I want us to go back and read the story, the act, this act, a second time, this time through the eyes, the heavy lidded eyes, of Rabbi Yochanan. This is an exercise in empathetic reading. But to get a sense of what this is like, to struggle in a world in which you cannot see, I want us to first look at number 11. This is an excerpt from Blindness, a chilling dystopian novel by José Saramago, telling the story of this awful epidemic that gradually turns the whole world blind. Can I have somebody else to volunteer to read, please? Thank you.
I am blind, and repeated in despair as they help me get out of the car. The tears running out made those eyes which you claimed were dead.
Just a bit more loudly. Project.
The blind man pleaded, "Please, will someone take me home?" Abandoned in the middle of the road, feeling the ground shifting under his feet, he tried to suppress the sense of panic that welled up inside him. He waved his hands in front of his face, nervously, but his mouth was already opening to let out a cry for help, and at the last minute, he felt the other's hand gently touching on the arm. "Calm down, I've got you." He proceeded very slowly, afraid of falling. The blind man dragged his feet, but this caused him to stumble on the uneven pavement. Stretching out his hand, he groped his way along the corridor. As he moved in the direction of the sitting room, despite the caution with which he advanced, running a hesitant hand along the wall and not anticipating any obstacles, He sent a vase of flowers crashing to the floor. He bent down to appraise the damage. The water had spread over the polished floor. He tried to gather up the flowers, never thinking of the broken glass. A long, sharp splinter pricked his finger, and at the pain, childish tears of helplessness sprang to his eyes.
Thank you. Now, with this image in mind, I'd like you to go back and read Act 2, Ezav Yochanan, and tell me what you feel. Yes.
It's immaterial.
Sorry?
Completely, his narrative there, his story about a blind man in the traffic, etc., is immaterial to our narrative.
Why?
There's nothing here that shows the person has to have a sight. He was a blind teacher. There are many famous blind teachers in history, who did extremely well. I don't think
he's doing well as a teacher.
Yeah, we should be looking at him here as a pitiful figure. He is certainly not that.
Does everybody agree with that?
Let's read and see how it goes.
Sorry?
Let's try it out.
Anybody want to? Yes.
He didn't know that the other guy who moved back 7 rows already.
I think he probably was the one ordering that he be moved back. But what can't he see about Rav Kahana? What is he missing?
Former students who left go to Babylonia.
No, no, no. This is somebody who came in from Babylon to Israel.
He can't see that he's strong. He can't see that he's got this posture of, you know, like all the things you said about him at the beginning when he was looking
out the guy's
throat.
He can't see that he's strong. What else can't he see?
He can't see that he's holding back.
He can't see Rav Kahana, who is sitting on his hands and biting his tongue and has smoke coming out of his ears because he's so desperate to say something, but he can't. That he's missing. What else is he missing? Who said that? Correct. The embarrassment. He cannot see the humiliated face of Rav Kahana being moved back all those rows. He can't see how crushed he is.
Can imagine that.
Sorry?
Cared.
I think he would have cared. Oh, actually, you know what? I answered too quickly. I'd like to think that it would have made him be a bit less severe. I'd like to think so. Maybe not. Maybe not, and we'll see what happens. But he's definitely being very oblivious to his pain at this stage.
On the other side, the fact that Rav Kahana saw that he was blind and pursues him in this way makes him look like the worst of a bully.
Good. And then the question is, does Rav Kahana actually know that he's blind? Yes?
Surely, even if he's blind, you can imagine putting the person back 7 rows is going to be embarrassing for a person.
Well, apparently that was a dumb thing. Apparently this isn't so extreme. Maybe it was more extreme being pulled back 7 whole rows in one go. But being moved up and down along the rows, that was like part of the daily fare in the classroom. I'd like to... Yes?
Maybe sight can be both external and internal, so maybe you lack insight.
Sorry?
Maybe you lack more insight.
He lacked more insight, certainly, yes, absolutely.
Now, the two of them had already encountered each other in reading number 4 here, when Rav Kahana started out.
That's a different version. That is a very different version. We can't necessarily create a continuum between those two versions. Yes?
Rav Yochanan, he didn't start out blind, right? He started out with sight.
Good.
Does this mean old age is interfering with his ability?
Good. And I'd like to paint the following picture. You're Rabbi Yochanan, the great Rabbi Yochanan, but you're growing old. and you're losing your sight, and you know that you're not as great as you used to be. And like many people in that situation, you are terrified that somebody might find out. So you go to that Beit Midrash every day, and you sit on those seven cushions, and you give the daily class with all of the authority and the strength that you can muster. And inside, you are deeply, deeply afraid. You're afraid precisely of what Rav Kahana ends up doing. You're afraid that somebody might come along and expose you for the frail old man that you are. It's a very different story all of a sudden, isn't it? Rabbi Yochanan, who until this moment seemed to be this high-handed, authoritarian despot, is now shown to be a scared, frail old man. Let's go back to our story. He said to them, lift my eyes, would you carry on?
He said to them, lift my eyelids for me, so that I may see him. They lifted them for him with a silver stick. He saw that Rav Kahana's lips were parted.
Whoa, stop again. What? What did we just discover now? Sorry? He has, well, for all intents and purposes, for the most time, he can't see because his eyes are covered up. But what do we discover about Rav Kahana?
He's mocking him.
No, you're going too far. His lips are parted. He has a cleft palate. A cleft palate is a severe facial deformity where the lip is slit all the way up to the bridge of the nose. It's a horrible defect. And so, although Rav Kahana in other places is described to be a beautiful man, here he's described as deeply ugly, as somebody who has a severe facial deformity. And again, we just discovered this now. And again, it changes the entire story. So what I want us to do once more is now go back and read Act 2 a third time, this time from the perspective of Rav Kahana, the perspective of a deformed immigrant. And to get us to understand what that is all about, I'd like for us to look at number 12. Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage tells the story of Philip Carey, who is a young orphan with a club foot. He's got a very, very bad limp. And the next passage tells of his first day in boarding school. Would you read?
The whole school rushed noisily into the playground. The new boys were told to go into the middle while the others stationed themselves along opposite walls. They began to play pig in the middle. Philip saw a boy running past and tried to catch him, but his limp gave him no chance, and the runners, taking their opportunity, made straight for the ground he covered. Then one of them had a brilliant idea of imitating Philip's clumsy run. Other boys saw it and began to laugh, and they all copied the first, and they ran around Philip, limping grotesquely, screaming in their treble voices with shrill laughter. The game was forgotten in the entertainment of Philip's deformity. One of them invented an odd, rolling limp that struck the rest as supremely ridiculous, and several of the boys lay down on the ground and rolled about in laughter. Philip was completely scared. He could not make out why they were laughing at him. His heart beat so that he could hardly breathe, and he was more frightened than he had ever been in his life. He stood still, stupidly, while the boys ran around him, mimicking and laughing. They shouted to him to try and catch them, but he did not move. He did not want them to see him run anymore. He was using all his strength to prevent himself from trying.
Please read the second act, the third time. This time it's Al Kahana, and tell me what this means. Ah, good. Yes.
He needs to prove himself.
Good. What else? Yes?
Is it possible that his lips were just parted?
No, no. It's actually a closed palate, yes. We don't have evidence of that. Right. But we don't, I think, in the story get any evidence of that. Yes? Ah, good. And again, I want to suggest this portrait for you. You are Kahana, and you were born ugly. And you know this. You know you have a severe facial defect, and you know that's the first thing anyone ever sees when they look at you. And like many people in that situation, you try and enhance your other strengths. Yes, I may be ugly, but I am really smart. I really know my Talmud. And so you become the star student in your yeshiva. But then you're forced to go in exile. And you enter a whole new world, and again, you know that the first thing anybody's seeing when they look at you is your defect. And you're desperate to prove yourself. You're desperate to show people, yes, I know my Talmud goes so well. And the rabbi of the yeshiva takes away from you the one thing you have. Again, very, very different story. Rav Kahana, who up to now seemed like a bit of a thug and a show-off, is now revealed to be this self-conscious, nervous refugee who is desperate for validation. Now, if this information is so important, if it makes us read the story so differently, why does the text wait until the very end of the act to reveal it? Why not tell us up front? Not rhetorical. Yes.
See what our reaction is.
Good. Yes.
I was supposed to judge people by the excellent.
Good. I'd like to say the Talmud does this on purpose to demonstrate how easy it is to not notice. How easy it is to be oblivious to the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses of those in front of us. It forces us as readers into a position of insensitivity. And that shock that we feel when we discover that one of the rabbis is blind and the other one has a cleft palate ought to give us pause. Because if we miss that, who knows what other pain and suffering and uncertainty we're missing. And just as we ourselves have ignored the pain of Rabbi Yochanan and Rav Kahana, so have each of them ignored the pain of the other. Rabbi Yochanan, in his blindness, can't see that this menacing lion, this threat that is in the first row, is actually a vulnerable, scared immigrant who's desperate for approval. And Rav Kahana is so busy talking with his cleft palate, is so busy asking questions, he can't see the feebleness and the insecurity of the great Rosh Yeshiva. And so the heavy lids of one and the cleft palate of the other are not just physical flaws. They're fatal flaws. These are severe ethical failings. Rabbi Yochanan can't see Rav Kahana. And Rav Kahana won't hear Rabbi Yochanan. Yes?
Can we go back to the windpipe now? Why he grabs out his windpipe?
Go on.
Maybe it's connected to... it's another, we're talking about different facial features. So maybe there's something symbolic in him trying to remove someone else's.
That's very interesting. That is very interesting. I don't think that point is made anywhere in the scholarship. You should write it up and publish it. I will just say that the reason the murder is sort of done by ripping out the windpipe is because we have another story about Kahana somewhere else where actually... somebody does die by getting a chicken bone stuck in their windpipe, and probably that element was carried over to our story. Yes?
I'm just curious, it seems like the Rav in Babylonia kind of set him up for this
his failure. Didn't speak for 7 years. Go there. He didn't send him up for success.
Actually, I would say that he tried to facilitate that success. In other words, his problem wasn't that he kept quiet. His problem was that he ultimately broke and spoke. Had he kept quiet for 7 years, it would have been a lot more smooth for him. The fact that he had to show off his knowledge and step on Rabbi Yochanan's toes, that was the problem. Yes?
Just in response to that, it seems like Rob probably knows his students. He probably
Absolutely.
Knows that this isn't going to go so well.
Exactly. He predicted this completely. I agree.
But, it seems like Rob's instructions aren't that valuable and that, Mahana isn't going to follow these. Like, if you know your student and you know that he's just dying to speak all the time, can you really tell him to not speak for 7 years and expect that to work out?
Correct. I'm not sure Rav would have done otherwise, other than sort of make him swear, which he did, and it did not hold. Yes.
I actually think the 7 years are okay. When he gets to the front row, still okay, they're face to face if he likes. If he continues for the next 7 questions,
good. I agree. It could have actually been solved peacefully until that point. Yes.
If we had seen the personalities before the end of the story, then we would perhaps have missed the shift in dreadful battle.
If you see it
later on, then we're able to appreciate the story, not only go back and reread, but actually appreciate the shift intellect which is going on.
Good. And in that sense, I do agree with that comment made earlier, that we should not be looking at these two men as somehow crippled or handicapped. We should be able to appreciate them as the great rabbis that they are, and only then are we given this information. Yes?
It's just upsetting to me because it doesn't seem that Rabbi Yochanan learned from his lesson, because he ends up also killing Reish Lakish.
Spoiler, everybody. That was a spoiler. We haven't actually heard that yet. Sorry? Reish Lakish. Sorry, I just did a spoiler because it's about Rabbi Yochanan as well. Correct. Again, I'm not sure we can create a sort of chronological continuum between these two stories because they're obviously two not historically accurate stories which actually borrow elements from one another. But yes, his character in these two stories is consistent and he does end up killing the people who challenge him most. Correct. Yes?
just to try to be nice to Rob and his knowledge of this student, he gave maybe a chance for redemption. Kahana took this, and instead of seeing the wisdom, which surely he had to appreciate on some level, went in and deliberately the night before politicized the situation. Because not to speak for 7 years would have meant to stay at the back of the room. I mean, that was the place that he would have inevitably been, and he knew that. Instead, this whole situation becomes charged with these egos and
good. And we'll see just how political the situation really is in just a bit. And I would like to add to that I think his first mistake was what he does the night before, where he basically shows off the knowledge and gets himself in the first row. Had he just walked in and sat somewhere comfortably in the middle, none of this might have happened. Yes?
I'm just confused about how these stories do when you're not here together.
Number four, they do not.
So how does one make sense of these stories? Okay,
so just very, very briefly, a word about the historiosity of a written narrative. 1 second. The stories in the Talmud are not historical. They are not meant to be taken as history. The rabbis were not intending to write history when they composed them. They might contain certain historical nuggets, such as the immigration of Kahana to Israel. But the details are not historical. Now, for a long time, people thought that because these stories were not historical, they were not interesting. And in recent decades, the scholars who now study these stories actually say it's because they're not historical that they are deeply interesting. Because if they are historical, they tell us what happened to one man once. If they're not historical, they tell us what an entire generation was thinking. Because these stories are educational. The rabbis basically wrote them to educate their generation. So it tells us a lot about what kind of agendas, what kind of worldviews and values the rabbis are trying to push.
But they are about particular individuals, like about Kahana. So
correct.
If you want to come away thinking that Rav Kahana is beautiful, Bible? Or
well, the rabbis, when the rabbis wrote this story in the Bavli, and different rabbis wrote a different story in the Yerushalmi, there wasn't necessarily a consciousness of the same audience reading the two stories.
There wasn't a consciousness of writing about the same individual?
Sorry? Yes, but you see, it's our sort of Western notion that everything must fit together. They were very comfortable with these contradictions. They didn't bother them. They bother us. Okay? All right, yes.
Yeah. A connection with the number four, apropos of nothing. I mean, the seven, you have the 7 years and the 7 rows, and I think immediately of Joseph in Egypt with the 7 years. And then when the Tsar of something or the Tapachim said, well, I dreamed this, and he said, yeah, well, you're going to die. That's exactly what happens in number four. So he's a Yosef figure.
That's a very, very interesting connection. I think you can, to an extent, draw those lines between him and the sort of the Yosefic archetype, yes. But I want to go on. And let's go back to our story. Would somebody else like to take up the reading? Thank you. And we are... He saw that his Lathana's lips...
He saw that his Lathana's lips departed and thought he was laughing at
him. Okay, I'm just going to stop you there. He sees the cleft palate, and often people with cleft palate have not seen too closely, look as if they're smiling very broadly. Now, what happens when we are vulnerable, when we're insecure? We project. We see danger where danger does not exist. We turn perfectly innocent strangers into enemies. Rabbi Yochanan sees the cleft palate and is sure that Rav Kahana is mocking him for all of those questions he couldn't answer. And so Rabbi Yochanan remains blind even when his eyes are open. Go on, please.
He was grieved and Rav Kahana died.
Thank you. So, yes, okay, spoiler. Just like in Bava Metziah, where we have the phrase we have here is Chal Shabdate. Again, Rabbi Yochanan is devastated. And as we know, Rabbi Yochanan's devastation is never a recipe for long life. And Rav Kahana promptly dies. Go on, please.
On the following day, Rabbi Yochanan said to the students, did you see how bad one they made? That is the age they applied.
Thank you. On the next day, he comes in and he says to the students, did you see what that Babylonian did? And I'd like to say that question denotes a particular kind of discomfort with what happened. He's not entirely certain. He wants validation. And so he turns it into an us-against-him scenario. Did you see that Babylonian? Speaking about the political situation. It wasn't me this Babylonian was mocking with his tumbling pyrotechnics. It was all of us. He thought he was better than us Israelis. But that's what he always looks like, say his students. And Rabbi Yochanan understands what a terrible, terrible mistake he's made. He understands the depth of the tragedy. He realizes, with his great love of questions, that he has just killed the best disciple he ever had. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that one of the agendas being pushed in this story is Babylonians asserting their superiority over the Israelis. And to an extent we have this here. The fact that a young disciple from Babylon could completely vanquish the very senior rabbi in Israel shows something about the level of scholarship. In fact, Rav Kahana and Rabbi Yochanan are metonymous. They're symbolic of the place each of them represents. Rav Kahana is the younger one, but he's powerful and brilliant, just like the fledgling Babylon. And Rabbi Yochanan is the older, more established one, but he's growing weaker, just like Israel. So yes, there is something about establishing the superiority, the intellectual superiority of Babylon over Israel. But on an ethical level, I'd like to claim, the story establishes a direct parallelism between these two rabbis. Both of them kill. Both of them have a severe physical flaw, denoting an even more severe ethical failing. Both of them are pushed back or down 7 times. And both of them ultimately have to do tshuva. And it's to tshuva where we now turn in Act 3. This is the last paragraph on the next page, number 1. Would you read on, please? Thank you. So I'd like to start again with a setting of the scene. Where does this act take place?
A burial cave.
The cave in which Al-Kahana is buried. And I'd like to say, again, speaking about the hatred that the Torah inspired, that it's not for nothing that to effect a reconciliation, the rabbis have to be outside of the Beit Midrash. And so Rabbi Yochanan arrives at this cave and he sees a snake coiled around it. This is the Ouroboros. It's a Greco-Roman mythological creature, the snake that has its tail in its own mouth. And in Greco-Roman literature, it's generally associated with the underworld and the guardian of the dead. However, we have quite a few cameo appearances of this Ouroboros in our own literature. Look at number 13.
They brought up his, what's that word? And carried it to his father's vault, which they found circled by a serpent. Said they to it, O snake, open thy mouth, and let the son enter to his father. Thereupon it opened his mouth to them.
Okay, so the Ouroboros comes with an open sesame. And clearly Rabbi Yochanan is familiar with this because he uses it himself. Let's go back to our story. He said at the end of the first line.
He said, "Snake, snake, open thy mouth and let the master go into the disciple." But the snake did not open his mouth.
So that doesn't work, and he tries again.
Let one friend go into another. The snake still did not open. Let the disciple go into his master, whereupon the snake opened his mouth.
So only with the admission of Al-Kahana's superiority did the snake open its mouth. Rabbi Yochanan enters the cave, and the process of tshuva can begin. Go on.
He entered and begged the Lord mercy and praised him.
And here we have the third appearance of the root to raise, kan, ukme. Rabbi Yochanan had destroyed Al-Kahana in Act 2, and now he is bringing him back to life. Go on, please.
Said ye, Rabbi Yochanan, to him, had I known that such is the nature of the man, now, therefore, let the master go with us.
Thank you. And this is a complete reversal on Rabbi Yochanan's part.
How did you see the snake who was blind?
Sorry?
How did you see the snake who was blind?
Ah, it is not for nothing that the first thing we are told that he saw the snake. And I think it works symbolically that now his eyes are open. I'm going to get to that in just a little bit. Rabbi Yochanan knows what this invitation to Rav Kahana to come back with him to the Beit Midrash means. It means that every single day in the first row will be a brilliant, brilliant disciple who will constantly actually ukme him, who will ask him question after question he can't answer. And yet he's willing to do this. He's willing to share the limelight with Rav Kahana. Go on, please.
Said he, Rabbi Yochanan, to him, had I known that such is the nature of the master, I wouldn't have grieved. Now, therefore, let the master go with us. He, Rabbi Yochanan, replied, if you can pray that I will not die again, I will come, but if not, I will not come. He replied, I cannot promise you this. Said he, the hour has passed, what has passed.
Thank you. Says Rabbi Yochanan, if you promise not to go all Hashadate on me again, I'll come back with you. But I think we both know that's not going to happen. And this, I'd like to claim, this is Rav Kahana's complete reversal. Rav Kahana has just been offered everything he ever wanted. A chance to sit there and be brilliant every day and enjoy the admiration of people who previously just looked at him and saw an ugly man, who would be now looking at him and seeing a brilliant, revered scholar. But Rav Kahana realizes what price that would mean for Rabbi Yochanan, how difficult that would be for him. And he chooses, maybe for the first time in his life, to remain silent. And this is a complete tshuva, both of Rabbi Yochanan and of Rav Kahana. Rabbi Yochanan, for the first time, can really see Rav Kahana. And again, the first thing is that he saw the snake, Chaza. And Rabbi Yochanan, for the first time, opens his eyes. And Rav Kahana, for the first time, closes his lips. Let's read on. He, Rabbi Yochanan, raised him up.
He, Rabbi Yochanan, raised him up and asked an audience for his food that he had in installments for him. This is the meaning of what Rabbi Yochanan said. When I have obesity, to be yours, Israelites will look back there at the moment.
Thank you. So here we have, you know, the admission of Babylonian superiority. Actually, all of the Torah we have is really Babylonian. If you'll notice, Act 3 is a complete reversal of Act 2. If in Act 2, Rav Kahana comes to Rabbi Yochanan's Beit Midrash, in Act 3, Rabbi Yochanan goes to Rav Kahana's burial cave. If in Act 2, Rabbi Yochanan is the rabbi and Rav Kahana is the disciple, in Act 3, Rav Kahana is the rabbi and Rabbi Yochanan is the disciple. If in Act 2, Rabbi Yochanan kills Rav Kahana, in Act 3, he brings him back to life. And if in Act 2 we have a situation where Rav Kahana can't ask questions and Rabbi Yochanan can't answer questions, a complete failed dialogue, in Act 3, Rav Kahana answers all of the questions that Rabbi Yochanan asks. And for the first time, these two rabbis achieve dialogue. Look at... Yes?
I have a question. I don't know what that is. Rabbi Yochanan, from my memory, I may be wrong about this, but Rabbi Yochanan was often quoted, ultimately, the law was often quoted according to him. I don't know what put him as a opinion.
Correct.
You know, so it's very interesting to know that it seems to be that the last thing that's following me is maybe thinking of yourself more like reading the law of rabbis.
Wait, sorry, I missed that last sentence.
It's possible that for this statement, our whole halakhic life, based on the teachings of rabbis, is being shown here to have
right, so it's a very interesting point what you make. Yeah, we have countless laws quoting the name of Rabbi Yochanan, correct. He was the great rabbi of his time. He was the head of the greatest yeshiva of his time. I would like to say two things in response, though. First of all, even in the story, he is not his younger self anymore. He's older. And secondly, we must not forget that Rabbi Yochanan is an Israeli rabbi. The person writing this story is a Babylonian rabbi who lived many, many years later and has a particular agenda to push. And it's not important. Rabbi Yochanan is not important here. Rabbi Yochanan is just a symbol for the declining Israel. Yes.
What is the meaning of all this violence here, that everyone is killing each other?
Ah, thank you. I want to try and answer that in the next few minutes, in which I promise I will end. But I would like to begin ending by looking at number 15, Martin Buber on the importance of dialogue. Would you finish off by reading number 15?
Speaking at one another does not make a conversation. As time of genuine religious conversation begin, not those folks of a fictitious conversation for another regarded as justice partner in reality, but genuine dialogue, speech from certainty to certainty, but also from one open-hearted person to another open-hearted person. Only then will genuine common life appear, not that an identical content of faith, which is alleged to be found in all religions, and that of the situation and anguish of the expectation, we may turn this way of deception to become aware. The limits of the possibility of dialogue are the limits of awareness.
Thank you. The limits of the possibility of dialogue are the limits of awareness. It's only with awareness, with being able to really see and hear the one in front of us, that we are able to achieve dialogue. And I'm going to go back to your question, what's with all the violence? I started off by saying there is something about our Torah-based debates that is particularly violent. It seems in our religious controversies, we get so caught up in the halachic and ideological and political aspects of the debate, we overlook the personal. In our passion to advance our causes, we often don't notice whose toes we're stepping on, whose sensibilities we might be offending, who we may inadvertently be putting to shame. I had a professor who many times would say to me, when will you learn to be tolerant of other people's prejudices? And I argued with her a lot because, damn it, prejudices are not something you're meant to tolerate. But you are. Not because they're right, but because they're there. All of Rav Kahana's Talmudic knowledge didn't help him in the end. He offended Rav Yochanan, and so he had to die. And all of Rav Yochanan's authority didn't help him, because in his paranoia, he ends up killing an innocent man. It's not just what we stand for. It's the way in which we stand for it. The causes we may advance may be the most halakhically correct, the most ethically superior, but unless we stand for them in a way which really sees and hears our adversaries, we ultimately will not succeed. And so as we try and fight our religious fights and struggle for what we believe to be true in the study of our Torah, I'd like for us to keep this story in mind, this tragedy of rabbinic rivalry, and try to be a little more kind, a little more sensitive of the vulnerability of the one in front of us, a little more tolerant of his or her prejudices. So, although we might be enemies now, we will ultimately come and love each other in the end. So,